Is your aging AC system ready for summer? Are you sure? Don't get caught when it's hot out. Instead, plan ahead with a free AC system inspection by Kelly's Heating and Cooling. Kelly's cares. So this spring, they're offering free home HVAC inspections. Appointments booked before the end of April might qualify for up to $8,900 back on a new high-efficiency, space-saving Daikin Fit system. So make sure you can take the heat this summer. Search for Kelly's Cooling online. Because they're more than hot air, Kelly's cares.
Any Hour Services free furnace sale is going on right now. The estimate's free, and when you have Any Hour Services install a new air conditioner, we'll give you a new furnace for just the cost to install it. For more information, call Any Hour Services or schedule online at anyhourservices.com.
This is Wheel Bearings. I'm Dan Roth.
I'm Sam Abual-Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
And I'm Rebecca Lindland from Rebecca Drives.
I forgot to say where I'm from. You're all just going to have to find me. I'm not writing.
Just Google them.
Yeah. Just, I mean, no, what happens if you Google Dan Roth, the guy who was the content chief for LinkedIn comes up. And you know, strangely enough, nobody has offered to interview me for something by making that mistake of thinking I'm that guy. But anyway, so one thing before we get to the show, I want to keep it tight, but I was looking around at when I posted the latest episode, which there was a huge delay in editing. I'm sorry. I was
you
looking
can blame
at where
Dan for that.
It was totally my fault. I just I couldn't get to it. There was just stuff, and then it took a while to edit. Because we had platform problems. Let me tell you. if you were to hear the raw audio, just the amount of like, can you hear me? I can hear Dan and I can hear Rebecca, but I can't hear Sam. Just anyway, when I posted that episode, I looked at the metrics for our show. And can you guys guess where our largest group of listeners is from?
You mean from a country or city?
City.
I think, if I recall, isn't it like in the Northeast? Like where you guys are?
Yeah, it is ish. It's funny, I don't have my other laptop down here, so I don't have it open. But you'd think it would be like Detroit or something, right? It's not. It's a town in New Jersey.
That probably means that there's a bunch of people going through a VPN or something, or some host that's in New Jersey.
I
was born in New Jersey. I'm just saying, it's my entourage. Now
what
you know.
Part of Jersey though? Like, I mean, were you like
Bergen County?
Okay, Bergen County. I think this may actually be Bergen County.
I was born in Englewood Hospital.
Okay. I don't know enough about New Jersey geography to recall whether this town, and I forget what the name of the town is. So
yeah, that would be
probably, helpful. I sort of like intro'd this poorly, clearly. I was surprised to find that we have, and there's like 400.
It's west of Newark.
Okay. Well, there's a lot west of Newark.
Mendham, New Jersey.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I was like, what the hell is that?
It's like out in the middle of nowhere.
Shout out to Mendon, New Jersey.
I wanted to shout them out because I didn't realize that it could be like a VPN. That's a good idea. That may be more of what it is. But Jersey is a place I've driven through and in. my favorite part of Atlantic City was the Target in Pleasantville.
See, there you go.
Which was anyway. Speaking of driving. So let's try this. We'll give it like roughly, I don't know, 12 minutes per person here. See if we can keep it on track. But Sam, you had a very jeepy time, so I think that might be a good place to start with what you've been driving.
Yeah. So when we last got together and recorded, I had just received the new 2020 Jeep Gladiator Mojave, which was announced at the last live event that we were actually at, that Rebecca and I were at in Chicago, the Chicago Auto Show. So the Mojave is the first what they're calling desert rated Jeep. So Jeep has had the trail rated badge for a long time. This is on all the various Jeep models. You know, the most off-road capable version is gets a trail rated badge. So on the Wrangler, it's the Rubicon. On everything else, it's the various Trailhawk models. And, you know, these get, you know, the part-time four-wheel drive with a two-range transfer case and the really low final drive ratio and all this stuff, you know, so for crawling over boulders and through canyons at, you know, low speeds. The desert rating, which they're putting on the Mojave and which will be coming to other Jeep models, that Jeep has acknowledged this, is designed more for high-speed off-road operation. So in a way, it's most similar to the Ford Raptor, the F-150 Raptor. And, you know, obviously this, the Mojave, or the, rather the Gladiator is a significantly smaller vehicle than the Raptor. But it's the Raptor, I think, in terms of performance, you know, in terms of its capabilities, is really the most direct comparison to the, to this Gladiator Mojave. And to be honest, I like this a whole lot more than the Raptor. Even though the Raptor is a lot more powerful, I like this. I like driving it a lot better than the Raptor. When I drove the Raptor, to me, it felt kind of soft. You know, it was too softly sprung. You know, it was kind of felt kind of underdamped when you went around corners or even over bumps. You know, it kind of felt kind of floaty. You know, this one with the Mojave was really buttoned down. You know, the ride and handling on roads was really great, but when I took it, you know, I didn't really have a desert to drive it on, unfortunately. When I go outside, you know, out in the outskirts of town, there's some, you know, some gravel roads, some dirt roads around here, and we'd had quite a bit of rain and the roads hadn't been graded recently. So you get these really nasty potholes in these dirt roads. And I took it across there, you know, at about 50 miles an hour. And I mean, it just soaked them right up. This thing has really good wheel control and body control. You know, it felt really solid, really stable. And it felt like something that, you know, if you took it to Baja or, you know, to Death Valley or something like that, and, you know, went racing across the desert, it would be fine. It wouldn't have no problem at all handling that stuff. And as I said, it's, you know, this is really a mid-sized truck. You know, size-wise, it's more competitive with something like the Tacoma or the Ranger or, you know, Chevy Colorado. But, you know, in terms of its capabilities, there's really, I don't think there's anything else quite like this. You know, it's got these Fox shocks, Fox dampers with remote reservoirs. And the ones on the front, they actually, on the rear axle, the reservoirs are actually mounted, you know, right on next to the main damper tube, next to the shock tube. So you have the shock tube and then the other one, you know, right next to it in parallel. The front reservoirs were actually, they had longer lines going to them, and the reservoirs were actually mounted horizontally up underneath the front skid plate to protect them. So, you know, they've done all kinds of things like this. And, you know, one of the things I noticed, you know, is the running boards, you know, instead of being down low, you know, to make it easy to step up into, they're tucked up right up against the bodies, you know, so they actually get maximum ground clearance. Yeah, Rebecca.
I have a question. Yeah. And by the way, we're doing this on Zoom, so now we can see each other, which will hopefully prevent me from interrupting. What is the reservoir for?
So the reservoir, the damper reservoir gives you more hydraulic fluid in the damper.
Okay.
And, you know, when you're doing, you know, this sort of off-road running, you know, when the wheels are moving around a lot, the more the damper moves, the more heat builds up in the fluid, and then it starts to fade, and you can, you know, eventually it can boil, right, and you lose your damping effectiveness. So having that external reservoir gives more capacity of the damper fluid, and it allows it to flow in and out of there and cool and keep it cooler.
So it
functions better over longer periods of time.
Right. Okay. Clever. Thank you.
And yeah, it allows Jeep to charge more.
It does allow Jeep to charge more. I mean, they're not the first to do this. You know, no. The Chevy Colorado, there's the ZR2 version, which, you know, they use Multimatic dampers, which also have remote reservoirs like this.
So, but that seems to be like the most, the straightest comparison other than the Raptor. which is larger, would be the Colorado ZR2. But they seem like they're kind of different things. Like the Mojave seems like it's more of like a pre-runner than the Colorado ZR2, which is more of like it's for crawling.
And yeah, the ZR2 is tuned more for rock crawling. It's more like a Rubicon type, you know, like a Gladiator Rubicon, even though it has those similar type of dampers. I actually really enjoyed driving this thing. And, you know, the one I had had the fold back roof, you know, so it's not a power roof. It's not the Sunrider roof, which is powered.
That's the one you like, Rebecca. It's the Sunrider.
Yes. That's the one that I had in March.
Right. So this one, did you have that on the Gladiator or the Wrangler?
Yes. I had it on the Gladiator where it was like a cloth roof. Yeah.
Yeah, so this is kind of like that, but it's manual. So there's just two latches at the windshield header.
I think mine was manual as well, though.
Okay, so to use this one, you know, to actually open it up, it's not like, you know, on my Miata where, you know, I can sit in the driver's seat, unlatch it, and drop it back.
Yeah.
This one, because it's up higher and the roof is longer, you actually have to get up, you know, push it back from the driver's seat and then get in the back seat and finish pushing it all the way to the back.
In other words, you need friends.
That's a commitment.
Well, no, you can do it yourself. It's easy enough to do, but it's just
okay. Get in the back there.
It's better with friends.
It's a little more tedious.
Exactly. It's better with friends.
Yes. But you know, I really enjoyed driving it. This one, the only engine that's available in the Gladiator, in any Gladiator right now, is the 3.6 liter Pentastar, which is a great engine. I'd like to see FCA put a V8 in the Gladiator, offer a Hemi in there, or at least offer the V6 from the Ram with the e-torque, mild hybrid system on there. So you get some extra torque. It's not bad with what it's got, you know, with the 285 horsepower, but it could use a little more torque because, you know, I mean, this thing it's fairly hefty. And there is one amazing thing that I did find when I was looking through specs. You actually can get the Gladiator, even in Mojave trim, with a 6-speed manual transmission.
Nice.
So you can
get
a
manual. They know their audience.
Yeah. So you can get a manual Mojave, or, you know, the one I had the 8-speed automatic. And, you know, it was equipped with all of the driver assist, you know, it had adaptive cruise control and everything. Cause you know, God knows you need adaptive cruise control when you're racing through the desert.
I mean, you don't want to hit a cactus.
That's right.
Hey, so one feature, so I used to actually do a lot of desert driving, when I lived in Saudi Arabia. And one of the key things that you have to do when you drive in the desert is you've got to let air out of your tires. Mm. Is there any mechanism for doing that in a controlled environment automatically, or is it still very manual tire by tire?
That would be a manual process in this one.
Okay.
So, you know, there are, you know, power outlets in this thing. So you can bring along, an inflator,
right.
You can bring along a compressor, and you know, you got a decent sized bed so you can, you know, put stuff like that in the bed. But yeah, you would have to drop the tire pressure manually.
That strikes me as a missed opportunity for Jeep. You know, because like Hummer had it back when they in like '96 when they introduced
the consumer H1.
It was the CTIS, right? Central Tire Inflation System.
Right, but that was, you know, that was something, you know, that came straight from the original military version of the Humvee.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
they never offered that on the H2 or H3.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But people are used to spending money to tart up their Jeeps. I'm sure there's an aftermarket solution.
I'm sure that there's somebody in Mopar that's probably working on something. You know? And you're right. There's probably somewhere there's an aftermarket solution for this. But yeah, there isn't from the factory right now.
So what else do you have to do to drive on sand? I've heard you got to kind of like be aggressive and just floor it.
You got to go fast.
Yeah.
I think that's almost the hardest thing to get used to because I was used to rock crawling, you know, that, you know, really low speed, you know, rock by rock or tree by tree and trying to, you know, maneuver. And once you're in the sand, you have to stay on top of the sand. You know, you can't dig yourself in. And so the way you stay on top of the sand is by going really fast, which was really a huge difference. And, you know, it's a shame because Jeep was planning a program at the end of March. I can't remember where it was supposed to be, but, you know, for sand,
probably
for
the Mojave somewhere.
Right, for the Mojave. But that's the number one difference between off-road dirt and off-road sand.
And, you know, it's very similar if you're running in deep snow. You know, I don't have much experience driving in sand, but I have had a lot of experience driving in deep snow, you know, during my ABS and traction control development days. And so, you know, it's a very similar kind of thing. You do need to keep your momentum going, you know, and keep the wheels riding up on top of that. Snowmobiling is similar as well. You want to keep
moving. Yeah, it does. It gets up on top. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want to sink down.
Yeah, momentum, anytime you're off-roading, momentum is really key to understand when you need to apply pressure, how much you need to apply. You've got to have a really gentle foot on that accelerator because you can get stuck just trying to get, I remember being on a Jeep program and we were in Jackson Hole, and what was supposed to be the snow course ended up being the mud course. Ooh. And because it was warmer than expected, and it was just a mess, and it was fine because we had a lot of fun with it. But I remember trying to get up this, it was like a 45 degree turn, and with in between two trees, the width, and I was in the Grand Cherokee. So it's the width of the Grand Cherokee. And the guy in front of me in a Wrangler, he couldn't get up there because he kept chickening out. Right. Mm-hmm. Like as you get up there, as you're making that turn, you've got to keep going. Yeah. And that was, you know, that's so momentum, you know, understanding how much momentum you need and the fact that you can't chicken out because you're going to get screwed off road every time. Well,
one thing that helps with that is if you have a front camera, and
this
Mojave did have the optional grill mounted camera. So, you know, as you're coming up over those crests, you know, you can see what's on the other side, you know, it'll display it on the center screen. And, you know, that definitely helps a lot.
Well, and in this case, it would have helped to see how close that tree actually was because we were heading right towards the tree.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the Mojave starts at just shy of $44,000. And that's with the 6-speed manual. The one I had, which was reasonably well loaded. It wasn't full. It didn't have all the available options because it did have the soft top, the retractable soft top. All told, it came to just shy of $61,000, including that $1,500 delivery charge that we talked about last time around.
So much money.
You know, that includes $2,000 for that 8-speed automatic transmission. So, you know, that's a pretty hefty option price. And, you know, there was a lot of options on this thing, but it is a lot of fun to drive. I don't think it's a vehicle for me. The one other, you know, to the degree I would have a complaint about this thing was the fuel economy. You know, it's rated at 17 city, 22 highway.
I got about 11.
I managed to get about 15.
Oh, that's pretty good. That's better than I thought you would. Yeah.
So the Rubicon 4x4 that I had was 62,000.
Yeah.
Gladiator Rubicon.
After they picked up the Gladiator, they dropped off the new Wrangler EcoDiesel.
Oh, that's right.
And that's like a $5,000 engine there, right?
It's four grand for the engine. And then, you know, you can't get the diesel with the manual, so you have to also pay for the $2,000 8-speed automatic.
That's the 3-liter diesel that's in the Grand Cherokee too, right? Or is it?
It's an updated version of the diesel. So it's based on the same design, the same architecture as what was previously in the Grand Cherokee. Yeah. But you know, they relaunched it last year. They did a whole bunch of updates to it, relaunched it in the Ram 1500 and in the Wrangler. And I would assume that at some point it's going to be available in the Gladiator as well.
Is it still laggy?
It's better.
Yeah.
There's still some lag, but it's not as bad. It's definitely better than it was. You know, it's got some of that, you know, classic diesel clatter, which you tend to hear more in something like the Wrangler, because you don't have nearly as much sound insulation in there.
Yeah.
You know, when you put it in something like the Grand Cherokee, you know, you open the hood, you're going to see all these sound mats, you know, under the under the hood and on the firewall and things like that.
Yeah, but even in the Grand Cherokee, it was louder than I expected, and it didn't sound good. It sounded kind of industrial, which is like a little out of character. I think though, in the Wrangler, is you probably get a pass on some of that noise, and it might be one of those things that like that's part of the charm. Like that's the shtick.
Yeah, it's part of the character of this type of vehicle. So the one I had was, you know, Wrangler Unlimited. It did, you know, it did have the Sunrider power roof, which is, you know, very, very nice to have. You know, just press the button and the whole thing zips all the way to the back. You know, so that's a nice feature. And you know, it was a Rubicon, you know, so it had the you know, the 2-speed transfer case and everything. And I know when I've driven the Rubicon out at the Chrysler Chelsea Proving Grounds on their off-road course there, you know, one of the fun things is when you put it in four-wheel drive low, you know, the way these things are geared, they're geared so low that, you know, in fourth gear at 10 miles an hour, the thing's turning like 4,000 RPM. Yeah, and this is another difference with the Mojave. The Mojave also has that 2-speed transfer case, but because it's designed for higher speed operation, you can run in four low at speeds up to about 35 miles an hour. In the Rubicons and the other trail rated Jeeps, it's only up to about 15, 16 miles an hour is the maximum speed. And in the Rubicon or the Wrangler Rubicon, that thing I managed to get 22 miles per gallon, which is by far and away the most I've ever gotten with a Jeep, you know, with any Wrangler based vehicle.
In a diesel?
Yeah, it's a diesel.
22 miles.
Yeah.
You gotta spend $9,000 though.
But, wow. No, it's only six. It's only six. Okay. Let's not exaggerate here. Four grand for the engine, and you know, let's face it. You know, most people are going to get the automatic anyway, so you know you're gonna pony up that $2,000 for the automatic on for almost everybody.
Yeah, that's true. That's like okay. A
so
cost.
So let me ask you a practical question. Mm-hmm. Why is the diesel in there?
Well, better fuel economy, obviously, but really, I mean, really more for towing, you know, it's,
oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. So
if you're going to tow with a Wrangler, you probably want to go for the diesel because, you know, that torque is going to help. There's gotta be
better. I mean, are there better choices for tow? I don't know. I have to get back into my off mode.
I think Wrangler Unlimited owners are probably more likely to actually tow. Like they're going to want to tow with it and they're going to use the capability versus like a Ram 1500 owner who may not tow as much, even though it can probably tow more than a Wrangler. But I think that the Jeep knows its niches, right? They're doing what BMW is doing. It's just trying, they're filling all of the spaces with an offering. Yeah. I mean, me personally, I think that the thing for Jeep to do is just make them all the e-Torx. And not offer the standard Pentastar, but that'll boost your fuel economy. But you can't really tow with the hybrid as well as you can with the diesel. So
with the e-Torque you can. The e-Torque you don't really give up any towing capability.
Does it gain towing capability with the diesel? I would assume it does.
I think it does. It does do a little better in towing with the diesel, certainly compared to the standard Pentastar. It's definitely better towing. And, you know, the thing about towing with the diesel, and, you know, this is the rationale that Ford gave, you know, when they launched the diesel version of the F-150 is, you know, this one is for the people that are going to be towing all the time, you know, or a lot of the time. You know, if you're towing is limited to, you know, 2, 3, 4 times a year, you know, like, you know, towing your boat from your driveway out to the lake in the spring, putting it in the water and then hauling it out.
You just rent the truck from U-Haul. And if it slides backwards into the lake, Oops.
Yeah. Well, no, but what I'm saying is, you know, if that's kind of your, if that's your towing pattern, you know, then using, you know, using the regular, you know, EcoBoost V6 is fine. Yeah. But the thing is with the gas engines, when you're towing, your fuel economy just goes right in the toilet.
Oh yeah. And the turbos get red hot and stuff.
Yeah. Whereas with the diesel, you know, it maintains almost the same fuel economy when you're towing. So if you're towing, you know, every other weekend or every weekend, you know, towing your horse trailer to shows, or if you're a landscaper, you know, towing all your lawnmowers around, you know, then the diesel makes a lot more sense. And, you know, living here in Michigan, one of the things you see, you know, if you drive up north during the wintertime, you know, on Friday afternoons, you will see a lot of people towing their snowmobiles. Mm. Or even in the summertime, you will see people towing their trailers, you know, with a couple of jet skis on there, yeah, towing them up north, you know, Sunday afternoon, bringing them back, you know, coming back home. And that's a pretty common thing here in Michigan. And so, you know, if you're doing that, you know, every weekend or every other weekend, having the diesel is actually a really good option. You're going to do, sure, a lot better in that, okay, case.
I gotta say, like, as a tow vehicle, God, I could not. Wranglers are something I get sort of out of my system every now and then. You know, I'll spend some time in one, and I'll be like, "All right, that's fun now. I'm good for a while. I've had my fix." I cannot imagine putting long towing miles on in a Wrangler Unlimited. Like, as much as I like them, that is a car that wears you out. That it just,
the new ones are so much better though.
They are good. They,
I mean, I know
good,
what, but you mean. There's somebody in my family has had a Jeep almost consistently for the last 20 years. So I get it. But the new ones are so much better.
They are.
I
mean,
they really are.
Like my brother has the JK, the previous edition.
Yep.
And it's, I agree with you, Dan. Like it's kind of beastly.
Yeah.
But the new ones, they're just, I was really pleasantly surprised.
I think whoever did the, you know, I think they must've taken the driving dynamics guys, the handling guys,
yeah,
worked on the Rams and had them do some magic on the new Wrangler, on the JL Wrangler.
Yeah. It is really good. It is very good. And the last one I drove was actually a Gladiator, and I was quite impressed with how good it was, because I think it was a Gladiator Rubicon. So,
which is practically glowing from you. I'm, yeah, I'm like blushing for the Jeep.
what I want is a Gladiator Mojave with a Hellcat in it.
Yeah, I mean, awesome. You know they're going to do that at some point.
Oh, like, yeah.
You
know, at the very least, they will build one to take to the Jeep Easter Safari.
Right. Look, they're looking for it. This is hilarious. FCA decided that they were going to move to the Netherlands to dodge taxes. And now they're asking Italy for what, like $6 billion?
Yeah.
It's like, so when they need to print some money, they're going to put the Hellcat in something.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, this EcoDiesel Wrangler was not inexpensive. Came to $65,100 delivered. That's a lot of money.
That's commitment, man. But
84 months free financing, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We'll chain this sucker to your ankle for a decade. At least the Wrangler's going to hold on to its equity.
Gosh.
You're going to. But
yes, for sure.
I'm going to be really curious to see how they price the plug-in hybrid Wrangler when that comes out later this year.
That's just a wrong statement. I'm sorry. I've had a glass of wine, so my filter is low.
We should make that a habit. That's our podcast starter kit. But you know, like the problem I have with the FCA diesel is that other diesels exist now in the light duty trucks, and like the F-150 diesel is fantastic. That's, mm-hmm, such a nice engine, and it makes the F-150 just that much better. I don't even like the F series, but I would pick that before I pick the Wrangler with the diesel. But I guess again, like when you want the Wrangler diesel, like that is a commitment. And so you know what you're buying, and you're buying it for a reason. So it may not be cross shopped like that. I don't know, but just, yeah, I'm not a huge fan of that 3 liter engine, that 3 liter diesel. But I haven't tried it in a while. So
You know, I've driven the previous iteration of it in the Ram, and certainly in the Ram, you know, it it felt a lot quieter, a lot smoother.
Yeah.
You know, it's definitely a little noisier in this one, but you know, it's a Wrangler. So you expect everything to be noisy.
Right. Exactly.
Is the cat bothering you? Lucy bothering
yes. you? I have my headphones on, and at first I was like, what is that noise? And then I looked down and she's just like, yeah.
We had and pets will do that. We had a school conference today. And so the dog decides he wants to just like climb on us. So we're sitting there in the middle of the school conference and all the other nerd school parents are there too. And just the 50-pound Labrador just jumps in my wife's lap. It's just excellent. I'm just like, oh, Jesus. Of all the things you could do in front of all the people, whatever.
Hey, I think these days people are used to that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
exactly. It's okay. You're not going to go viral for anymore for having your dog or cat or kid come in on your Zoom call.
That's true. Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah.
All right. Well, so you know what? We blew the time limit on that one.
Yeah.
We had two cars.
Yeah, that's true. All right. We're still doing okay then. But I was surprised. My eyebrows went up when Sam told me what you're driving, Rebecca, because I was just like, well, that's a very, like, A, it's a cool car, but just to be ripping around, I could just, I don't know. It just doesn't fit with all of the cars that we've had lately. This one sort of sticks out. So you tell us more about it.
So I had the Toyota 86, which of course used to be the Scion FRS. Right. And this
thing
was
still also the Subaru BRZ.
Oh, yes, exactly. Which I have not driven. This thing was just a riot. It was
You had
Hanconi. Thank you. Yeah. The Hanconi edition. So it's this beautiful like British racing green with these gorgeous bronze twisted alloy rims on them. And you know, the thing is just a riot. It's old school, it's classic. This is a driver's car. That's it. But what I liked about it was that it didn't skimp on amenities. I mean, it had really nice, comfortable seats. It had Android Auto and Apple CarPlay, and it had heated seats. It had some nice amenities to it. What it didn't have was like a great, like the backup camera was in the rear view mirror. So it was that tiny little thing. The multimedia screen is 7 inches. I mean, it's totally old school. But it was kind of fun because then you're reminded that your only job in this car is to drive it. And it's a 6-speed manual, the one that I had, the Hanconi edition. And a 6-speed automatic is available. But, you know, I got in it and I was like, oh, this is hilarious. Like, there's no place for your phone. There's barely any cup holders. Like, it's really bare bones. But, man, you can just toss that thing around and it's happy.
Yeah, I love the 86. And it still feels like a fresh face in the sports car world.
There's none of them around. You don't see them anywhere.
They are pretty rare. And, you know, it's a lot of people have criticized it over the years, particularly for the engine.
I've done my fair share.
I think it's fine.
I do too. Like every time I drive it, I'm like, this is actually okay. What I don't really like is the way that the torque delivery sort of drops off and then comes back at higher RPM. But once you learn to wring its neck, especially with the manual, it's fine.
just keep it at high RPM all the time.
Keep it exactly. Yeah. I just kept it at high RPM.
Yeah, and it's geared so that you can do that. But you just there's a little bit of a learning curve with it. I just love that it's that kind of car that you have to learn how it rewards you. And you have to find that sweet spot to really make it sort of come alive. So yeah, that's fun.
Right. It's nuanced.
Yeah.
It's like a woman or nuanced.
not going
you have
that.
To figure
you
us out.
Definitely need a glass of wine.
It's awesome though. I had a great time with it. And you know, it was actually really fun to not see myself coming and going to, you know, have other, you know, guys in, you know, boy racer cars pull up and they're like, oh my gosh, a librarian is driving that thing. You know, it was like, you know, it was just fun. And of course I absolutely love a manual transmission, and especially a good one like that. That's just so engaging and easy. You know, I found it super easy. It's, you know, it's just, it was smooth, quick shifting, you know, short throws. I thought it was great. I loved it.
Oh yeah. It's very nearly like a picture perfect sports car. I can't believe it's been around since 2012 too.
I know. Right. But because it was this, it was the Scion.
It was the Scion at first.
Right.
Yeah.
The FRS first. So the one that I had, it was the Hankone, as I said, it's named after a Japanese highway, 30,825, including destination, but it starts at 28,000. Yeah. So, you know, for 30 grand, that's just a lot of weekend fun.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, that's actually a really good value, you know, for what you get with this kind of car.
Exactly.
Yeah, so what they've been doing too is they've been consolidating equipment levels. So there's just probably not a whole lot of options you can get on the
I think there's three different kinds. There's there's the regular 86, there's the 86 GT, and then the 86 Hankone. And and you're right, there's not a lot of there isn't a lot of room in that. I think the base price actually of any 86 is 28,000. And this was like 20, a special. Yeah.
28 including delivery.
Right, 28 including delivery. And this was loaded at 30,800 with delivery. So
that's such a good deal.
Under 29, you know, without delivery. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you can swing that couple extra grand, it's worth it just for that green.
Oh, yeah, it's gorgeous. Like the green and the gold wheels and the interior. Is the interior brown?
The interior is this beautiful camel suede-like situation. And that's the other thing too, is that, you know, again, like the dashboard's pretty bare bones, you know, it was black, and, you know, black to me always kind of shows all of its flaws, but the seats were super comfortable. It was really easy to adjust, minimal blind spot issues for me as I sit up close. And the back seat was small. My 12-year-old niece got in and she was cozy in the back seat. So you know, I wouldn't encourage that situation very much, but you know, overall it was easy to get in and out of. It's low slung. I think the only thing that we should have is a sunroof. It didn't have any sunroof.
Yeah. No, it's a car about purity. You know,
it is. Yep. Exactly. So, you know, it was funny because when they told me I was getting it, I was like, okay, this will be interesting. Like you said, like to kind of see like, you know, what it was like, but I was really sad to see it go. I definitely could have had that thing in the driveway for a longer period of time.
Yeah. They're a fun car. I wish they didn't have that little deck lid spoiler, but now I'm getting picky on this version. Like I remember when it came out and everybody was sort of picking apart the styling because it's not real gimmicky, but I think that's one of the things that I love about the 86 is that it's pretty timeless. It's like, the first generation RX-7s or, you know, going back even further, like think about a Karmann Ghia, right? Like it just, like the Karmann Ghia was in production from like 1956 to 1974. Like 20 something years.
It was funny because Jake says, my nephew Jake, who lives with me, he says to me, he goes, "What's with the 80s Toyota?"
Really?
Wow. And I started laughing.
Kids,
I was like,
these days.
Well, it is the 86, but it's like, it's retro, right? Like that's what it's supposed to look like. Not really.
Really? Is that, no, I just like it's a really clean design.
It's got timeless. The classic sports car proportions.
Yeah.
You know, long hood, the cabin moved towards the back, you know, rear wheel drive. It's exactly what a sports car should be. There's, you know, there's only one minor flaw. It should be a soft top.
Yes, exactly.
And they shouldn't bother putting that ridiculous little back seat in there. I mean, it's pointless.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that may help out in some sort of regulatory fashion. But
yes, that's true.
You know, the thing that's great about the 86 is just like the thing that's great about the Miata is it will teach you a lot as a driver, and its limits are low, so the stakes are low.
Yes,
you can have a lot of fun with it no matter where you're driving.
Yeah.
Which is not the case with something fancier, even like a Mustang. A Mustang's going to hurt you.
Yeah. Right. No, it's true.
Especially if you're leaving a Cars and Coffee.
Right. Exactly.
No, I loved it for its purity.
Yeah.
It's just a fun, your only job in that car is to drive it. And I love that.
Okay. So everybody should get one. More sports
everyone
cars.
Should get one. Yeah. Everybody should get one.
And if you really want more power, an LSV8 will slide right in there.
There you go.
You can stick an LSV8 into just about anything.
I want one on my lawnmower.
I think it's been done.
Yeah, I think so. All right. Well, so you guys had all the fossil fuels. I, on the other hand, used no oil for the week. I had the Nissan Leaf SL Plus. And it's been a long time since I've been in a Leaf. So this is my first experience with this current generation Leaf. And I got to say, I really like it. And B, I think it's the best car that Nissan makes because it's so normal, which is like, it's weird to say like this thing it just works like a car and that's why it's the best thing that Nissan makes. But it really is like, they have really gotten this pretty refined. It's an affordable EV. It does 240, 250 miles on a charge. It's just easy to get in and drive and figure out. It's comfy. It's pretty roomy. Nothing fell off.
That's always a good thing.
And, you know, that's a big thing when you're buying EVs to make sure you pick one that doesn't drop pieces.
Okay, so you have to expand upon this for me. The best thing that Nissan makes.
You could argue, right, that the GTR or the 370Z might be the best thing that they make if we're talking in terms of sports cars. But it's the future of automobiledom in some way. And they've been at it long enough that if you step out of, I don't know, like say an Altima and into the Leaf, there's no learning curve. You just know how to make it go. The controls are like you can get the
HVAC as a conventional mainstream car.
Right.
It's perfect.
And that's it, just it goes on batteries instead of an engine. And like other EVs are concerned with all kinds of gimmickry and different, you know, screens and all the autonomous tech and stuff. And this had some ADAS stuff where, you know, lane centering. It had the Nissan
ProPilot.
ProPilot. Yeah.
ProPilot Assist or just ProPilot?
ProPilot Assist.
Yeah. And that works great. Like, it took me a little while to figure out that that button is what turns on cruise control. But once I figured that out and then figured out I could shut off the things I didn't want, it was fine. And it actually, it centers in the lane nicely. Although if you cruise in the right lane, it'll follow off ramps.
Yeah.
If you're not watching it, it'll be like, oh, the lines go this way. I must be turning. So you gotta keep kind of a hand on it if you're doing that. But you know, I went down and picked it up, and it was still kind of cold and raw. And so I was using the heater and stuff. I was like, I'm just gonna drive this like a normal car. I'm not gonna do any kind of like hyper miling nonsense or anything like that. And it had plenty of range. I used maybe 100 miles worth of range when I went and picked it up. So it took a while to top that 100 miles back up on 110. But it has a nice charger that comes with it, where if you can find a 220 outlet, there's enough slack on it that, you know, you can be pretty set in most situations. And the, you know, like the Nissan dealer in town has a charging station too. So I wasn't that concerned. I could go plug it in. But it's comfy. It's pretty quiet. The materials are nice. All the controls work well. It's a car. So if your choice is like, I'm going to buy, you know, a regular gas engine car or SUV or crossover or something, or I'm going to buy an EV, you don't have to sacrifice. You don't have to get some infernal machine. It's just a car, and I think that's what's brilliant about it, is that it's just so well done.
Well, and that's the lesson that Nissan learned going from the first generation Leaf to the second gen, you know, is the first one was designed more like a science project. You know, it had that weird styling, especially the headlights in the front.
Yep.
It had some weird things about the controls and the ergonomics inside. You know, and when they went to the second generation, they made it much more normal looking. You know, normal inside, normal the way things work, you know, and made it more like just a regular car that just happens to be electric. And I think that that's, you know, that's a good thing. Yeah, maybe turned off some of the early adopters, but you know, there's a limit to that market anyway. I mean, if you want to, you know, start to grow that business, you know, you've got to appeal more to a mass market, and that's what they did with the second generation, and I think they're going to go even further, you know, next year when they launch the new Aria, which is their new EV, crossover EV. And I think, Rebecca, did you have a chance to drive the Aria in Vegas at CES?
We sort of did. We had a modified opportunity. It was very much a pre-production vehicle on a little planned track. But yeah, I mean, I think this is, you know, one of my issues with the way that EVs have been developed and marketed is we have made them to be something weird as opposed to something mainstream. And I think that, you know, this is what I've talked about a number of times with the Audi e-tron is I would rather just have it the Q6. It's just a good, it's a good luxury crossover that just happens to be electric. And the idea of just constantly promoting these vehicles as this weird electric alternative powertrain, I don't know. I just think if we're going to appeal to the masses, we have to start making vehicles that appeal to the masses.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things about the Leaf that does appeal to the masses is that those are also things you can criticize it for, right? Like its tech, as much as I found it fine and easy to use, it's not as fancy as newer tech suites in other EVs. So that can feel a little antique. It like I said, it took a while to charge. It probably doesn't charge as fast as some other cars on the market. Now, I don't know.
What was your total range?
240 miles, it said. So I think officially
the SL Plus, like, right?
Right, right. Yeah. So how long did it take to recoup those 100 miles just plugging it into
it? Like a day and a half. It was on 110 and it was on a long extension cord.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so yeah. That's not a representative test. No. Yeah. Like I wasn't concerned. I was like, look, the dryer's right there. If I need to, I can move the dryer and plug it in to 220 and run the cord over and it'll charge a lot faster. But I wasn't going too many places, so I just left it on 110 slowly. But you know, 226 miles is I think the official range of it, and that's so much like it, totally fine. I didn't have any range anxiety and I drove it around a couple stops when I had it. It doesn't have all-wheel drive, I think, which is something that you might be looking for. It's not that sort of like this is a super fast 0-60 high performance thing that it's electric. It does look kind of cool. It looks a little different. Mm-hmm. So it sort of straddles the line between having some of that differentiation, but also just being a solid car. And you give up some of the gee whiz factor, but also it's like, I think it was about $45,000 before rebates or tax credits. So you can get it for, under 40, you can get it in the mid 30s. And that's a pretty good deal for a car. Yeah, you give up some of the stuff, but A, you can get it. It's in stock. You're not waiting. You have a dealer network, you have support, and it works. So I mean, most people don't need all-wheel drive. So
did you put snow tires on it? And what percentage?
I would.
What range would the? How much would the range go down? Do you think 10%?
It would probably go down more than 10%. I think you would lose some range in the winter, and certainly compounded with the different tires that aren't low roll.
Yeah, I mean the tires you're probably going to lose somewhere between 5-10% just from the tires, but you're going to lose you're going to lose a lot more just from cold weather driving and driving in
right.
Snow.
Yeah. But if you were to put snows on that,
yeah, you'd lose a bit, but it's less than what you're going to lose from the other winter factors.
Right.
The other thing to remember about the Leaf too is, you know, depending on what your needs are, what your driving needs are, if you can get by with 150 miles of range, you know, the base, you know, there's a couple of trim levels of the Leaf, you know, that start at 31,000.
Right. And that's true. And you don't really give up anything, before that, other than range, right? Like they're still just
inside
and stuff, which I honestly thought it was nice, but materials and stuff, it's not a luxury car. So keep that in mind, but it looked good. It felt
it's a mainstream compact hatchback, you know,
it was comfy. Yeah. I liked it quite a bit. And with the SL Plus, there's plenty of torque too. Like you put the foot down, this thing, it goes to the point where it'll jerk the wheel out of your hands with torque steer. When I was getting on the highway, I was like, let's see what it can do. It's got plenty of power.
That's awesome. Yeah. I love electric vehicles for people that, you know, like here in the Fairfield County area, once people start taking the train again, I love them for just going back and forth to the train station, because as I've said before, most of the parking at local train stations requires some residency, usually in the same town. And, you know, it's a good opportunity. It's a short drive and you can pretty much go almost all week without having to charge it. Yeah. And you're getting to and from the gas station for free. To the train station for free. You know, you're not paying for gas. And I love that idea. And I apologize if you can hear Lucy in the background. I don't know what she's so upset about. I don't know what she's so upset about. She
wants your attention.
I know she does.
Yeah. I think honestly, the sort of biggest knock on it is probably just A, that it doesn't have all-wheel drive. It's not a luxury car. And also, you know, charging might not be as quick, even though it can do DC fast charging. So I think you can put about 80% of the charge back in about 45 minutes, depending on the charger. And I on a level 2 charger at home, it's still going to take, if it's all the way down, it's still going to take you almost 12 hours to refill it. So that's you wait a little bit, for some of that stuff, but I don't really see those as actual issues. You know, right. Like you're charging it at home, you're not really using all of the capacity usually when you go out.
Well, so. And if you are getting an electric vehicle, you know, a level 2 charger is not prohibitively expensive anymore. Yes, there's everyone's situation is different. I realize that. But, you know, if you have the opportunity to put one in, I think it's definitely something to consider.
They seem to have it really well thought out. And they've put a bunch of these first gens in, you know, municipal fleets and stuff. So they've actually got a lot of EV experience too. So it's proven hardware. I would feel really comfortable buying this. More so than something maybe a little bit more exotic. I'm kind of trying to think, like, the only other cars that I would trust kind of as much might be like the Bolt, or the, like the Kona EV. And the Kona EV is smaller. The Bolt is smaller. This feels a little.
Yeah, the Kia Niro EV would be the, you know, the next closest one to something like this.
Yeah.
In terms of its size and its range. And you know, if you have a 240 volt outlet in your garage, you can go buy, you know, a level 2 charger for $400. You can get one on Amazon or from Home Depot or Lowe's for $400 and just plug it in and you're done. If you don't have a 240 volt circuit to your garage, you can, you know, you can usually get an electrician to put one in for about $500 or $600.
Yeah, or you can take two different circuits and strip the wires back and just, you know, one leg goes over here and one leg goes over there. And you tie the neutrals together and do not do that.
Yeah, please do not do that. You know, unless you are fond of having your garage burned down.
It's just not insane. Take suggestions.
Yeah, no. Don't listen to me. I wouldn't actually do that at my house just if I find it fast. All right. Well, that's the cars. I like the Leaf. I give it a pretty heady endorsement. Even though it's maybe not the sort of flashiest thing to drive, I quite like it.
Shall we stick with electric vehicles for a moment?
Yeah, let's stick with electric vehicles. What do we got?
Okay, so this week there was an article in Autocar. Actually, it started off, I think, in one of the British newspapers. I can't remember exactly which one.
Say the Sun. Why not? It's a tab. Oh, no, we don't want to promote it.
But, you know, one of the no, it was the Times. It was the Sunday Times. They published their annual rich list of the richest people in Britain. And number one on the list this year with a net worth of £16.2 billion was James Dyson. Of, you know, he of hair dryers and vacuum cleaners.
Vacuum cleaners.
Yeah. Well, we don't need to get into all the reasons why James Dyson sucks, you know, including his support for Brexit.
No, but, I just mean that it was a vacuum joke. So yeah. Anyway,
I got it. I did not read anything more into it.
Okay. I did.
I know that, you know, politically he's got some weird positions.
But, yeah. But, you know, a few years back we heard, you know, that Dyson wanted to build electric cars. And, you know, they set off and, you know, started a development program for an EV, and they made a bunch of investments. They bought up a battery developer from based here in Ann Arbor, led by a company called SACD3. It was founded by Professor Anne Marie Sastry, who was an engineering professor at the University of Michigan, because she had been working on solid state battery technology. And the plan when they announced it was they were going to do an EV with solid state batteries, and it was going to have 600 miles of range and ridiculously fast charging. And after they spent a few years working on this thing, you know, they had issues, which they didn't talk about in this article. Dyson never really mentioned anything about the battery technology. And, you know, the reality is that solid state batteries are still quite a ways out, you know, probably not towards the end of the decade. But, you know, They actually did develop the vehicle, and, you know, they have running prototypes, and this is the first time we've actually seen a photo of one of the prototypes, or at least the styling buck here. And in the article, he acknowledged, you know, and if you haven't heard previously, they announced last fall that they were canceling the project. They were not going to go ahead with it. But Dyson acknowledged in the article that it spent 500 million pounds, so that's about $620 million US dollars, on the development of this vehicle. And at the point when they canceled it. And
I spend that much on shoes every year.
I mean, it's okay, Imelda. How much is he worth? 13 billion pounds?
Yeah, 16 billion,
I think he said. Yeah.
No, you're gonna notice.
Up in a day. It's interest.
It's a tax write-off.
It's a blip.
Yeah.
But so they still own the tech, though, right? They haven't sort of liquidated.
They still own the tech.
Battery tech or the motor tech they still have something to sell.
Right. And they were actually supposedly leveraging some of the motor technology. I mean, probably the most interesting thing about Dyson as a company is they've done some really fascinating motor technology with switched reluctance motors. And we don't need to get into the details of that, but, you know, they're very efficient motors and, you know, very powerful. And they were going to use those use that technology in these vehicles. So they still own that technology. They still have whatever patents they had on the batteries, even though, you know, that's not anywhere close to production yet. But, you know, he acknowledged, you know, in canceling this thing, he said he took a look at the industry and saw all these other EV startups that were going out there, you know, producing electric cars at a loss, and realized it was just going to be too risky. You know, it was probably going to cost them several billion pounds more, you know, that they were going to lose by introducing this thing, you know. And in the original article, you know, it basically where, you know, that this was excerpted from, you know, said really the only companies that, you know, have any chance in this are those that have, you know, conventional vehicles to sell, you know, to subsidize this. You know, if all you're selling is EVs, you know, you're going to have a hard time ever surviving.
No kidding.
Yeah. We could have told them that.
The automotive news.
Could have saved
Europe.
Them half a billion pounds.
Yeah. Exactly. The automotive news Europe said that he would have had to sell it for £150,000,
yeah,
or almost $182,000 to make a profit on it.
But that,
as you say, we could have told him that you're not going to be able to make a profit on this.
And that's been the pattern, though. Like, that's any of the EVs that have launched really have been premium and that high-end exotic.
A lot of vacuum cleaners.
Anyway, because
that's the bottom line.
Because they're small entities and they need to at least break even or make a profit or have a road to profitability to be a real business, unless their main goal is to develop some tech and get bought out and sort of cash out. That just seems like you as a businessman should have been able to look into that and go, here's what's going on. And yes, of course, you need the other product lines that sell at volume, at profit, and much lower cost of production to sustain this other thing that sells at a loss, but the loss isn't great enough to consume all of our revenue. That, I don't know. I don't have an MBA, clearly. So,
well, it, you know, they sell a lot of vacuum, very expensive vacuum cleaners and blow dryers. So,
I mean, I love the design of it.
They should have been able to subsidize this thing.
But my Dyson Animal, I bought in 2007.
Yep.
And it's still going strong.
Yeah.
I haven't needed to buy another one.
that's true. And we have a DC 21, which is like, I really like the design of it. It's supposed to be compact and it's very cleverly packaged. And
right.
So it's one of those products that you look at and you go, well, they've really thought about this and it's really well designed and you can,
but it's almost too well designed because normally I would have had to buy a vacuum cleaner by now.
Yeah. Well, and the thing, like, our cord reel broke and I was like, well, BS with that. That thing was expensive as hell. I'm going to replace the part that broke. And it was, we waited for a while. We used to shop back around the house until we got the part.
My God.
I was just like, I'm not throwing this thing away. I'm not going to getting the part to fix it because it's just like,
it's ironic that he's making these kinds of batteries, because the other, when I got my Animal vacuum cleaner, I got a handheld one for free, speaking of which is what reminded me. And it worked out great for like the first year, but then now the battery doesn't charge anymore.
Yeah.
And so it technically needs a new battery. So maybe he can develop better vacuum batteries as well.
Yeah.
Car batteries. Use this technology.
Yeah. You could probably just hook it up to a diehard. Like put it in the backpack.
Right.
A little weightlifting while you're at it.
Just need a few of those, you know, portable phone charger batteries, you know,
exactly.
A 20,000 milliamp hour battery. Just
right.
Plug it in.
Yeah. That. I mean, it burned down the house. So like, you only have to vacuum once. I got sick of the Dustbusters because the Dustbusters have they have a battery that's internal. And you can't get at it. And so that's what happens after a year of like, it sits on the charger until you use it and the battery's, it dies. And it's so like, it starts off with great vigor and it's like, So I went to Home Depot and I got the little Ryobi one that uses the drill batteries.
Yeah.
So when the battery gets tired, just take those back, recycle them, get another one, pop it in, and just, it's ugly and it's not as spiffy as a,
I'll have to try that though.
Black and Decker,
you have some Ryobi batteries.
Ryobi, you know, 18-volt thing uses the same batteries as my drill.
Right.
So they're lithium ions, so they charge quick. That was my solution.
It's a good plan. I like it.
Okay, we're completely off topic.
All right, what else do we have?
Yesterday, Toyota did the vehicle reveals that they were originally scheduled to do in New York at the New York Auto Show, which obviously hasn't happened yet.
Did you watch it?
No, I was in another meeting at the time. So I was actually pre-recording a keynote for a conference that I was supposed to speak at that is going to be virtual. So I didn't get a chance to watch the presentation. Did you guys watch it?
I did not either.
I was busy. Started watching it, had to bounce to another meeting, but they have it posted. So I think anybody can actually go and watch it. It's only about 15 minutes, but you get to see they introduced the new Sienna and the new Venza.
Venza.
Yeah. I was surprised that they brought the Venza back. I mean, I think you guys probably knew it was going to happen. But I was like, oh, yeah, the Venza.
I actually hadn't heard anything about the Venza coming back.
Yeah, I didn't know it was coming back. It was ahead of its time, and so now they're going to redo it again.
It was. It had a terrible interior.
It did. It had a really awful interior. The first generation Venza. I drove one down to South Carolina. We were doing a thing at BMW at their performance center down there, adjacent to their factory in Spartanburg. And so we drove a Venza from Ann Arbor to South Carolina and back. And yeah, the interior of that thing I was actually really shocked. I remember I wrote a review for Autoblog at the time. And the fit and finish of that interior was really awful. I mean, you know, everything was the parts, you know, things were misaligned, the trim panels. It wasn't bad to drive.
Yeah,
but it just didn't feel like a Toyota.
What was going on?
I don't know. I never did really get an answer on that.
Well, it was like what, 2008, 2009.
Yeah.
Okay.
So everybody
that explains
had
a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Had to take money out of the interiors, had to take money out of the product, and the interiors is where it came from in a lot of cars. But the Sienna sort of, up until just now, had the same quality interior, same trash. Because I just drove a Sienna like the end of 2019, and I was like, this is garbage in here.
I drove one around the same time.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was so antiquated.
Yeah.
I think I said something about the seats couldn't fold up properly. Like, I mean, it was, I felt like I was driving a 15-year-old car.
Yeah, it was not okay. Yeah, so the new one, I don't know how they've done the seats and stuff. They don't seem to have really moved the needle on like some sort of stow-and-go competitor option, but they've upgraded the interior pretty clearly. It looks a lot nicer. The exterior styling looks a lot sharper. Seems like the internet was split on whether it looks good or bad. I think it looks good, but it's definitely more expressive in that modern Toyota way, which means it's kind of busy. But everything's busy these days. I don't know. I think it looks good.
It's basically, take the new Highlander and stretch it into a minivan, and that's what you have here.
And that's exactly what it is. And it has all-wheel drive, which I thought was cool, because there's not really that many choices for. I think
right, but Sienna then was. But does that mean that the floors are behind the rear axle then?
Well, actually, what's interesting about both the Venza and the new Sienna, only one powertrain. They're both hybrid only. They're standard hybrid powertrain. So it's the same 2.5 liter four cylinder hybrid system that's in the new Highlander. And that's the only option, except you can get all-wheel drive, and it's electric all-wheel drive. So you get an electric motor at the rear axle to drive the rear wheels.
Okay.
So it shouldn't, because the motor is pretty small, it shouldn't have any real impact on packaging at the back there to whatever
degree. So that will be interesting, because that will be a significant competitive advantage, though. Because all-wheel drive is, that's a big if nothing else, it provides peace of mind and a sense of safety and security, which when you're selling a family vehicle is a top priority, obviously.
Yeah, I think it's a really good move to differentiate the Sienna especially.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly.
These are all hybrids because A, you don't really care about performance. You're not missing any performance because it's a hybrid. It has plenty of torque. And really, you want to stretch every dollar. And so this is going to give you better fuel economy than the V6, which has plenty of power, but eats gas comparatively. So I think that was a smart move. And the all-wheel drive, I think, is a smart move. I do think that they probably are going to get dinged on not having some sort of real versatile way to fold the second row seats. The third row, I hear your concern, like, do they fold into the floor? Or like, where do they go?
Right. But like Sam said, if they are able to do something with the all-wheel drive and have an electric and a small motor, then they might be able to figure it out. But the folding seats nowadays, that is pretty much almost standard equipment, like expected to have seats that fold down easily, really with a touch of a key. And, I think that's something that it'll be interesting to see. I'll definitely watch it just to see how the seats fold. Because that should be something they highlight, since the current Sienna doesn't really do it that well.
No, they didn't really highlight it, which makes me suspect that
they're not. None of the photos on the media site show the third row seat, so you don't really see any of that. One thing they do show is that it does have an optional vacuum, built-in vacuum.
Yes, and a refrigerator.
Like Odyssey does.
Is it a Dyson?
No, I don't think so.
It's tying it all in.
That's nice. Nice of that. It looks like it's up in the base of the center stack, though.
It's right in the middle instead of out in the back.
Yeah.
Okay. So like not like Honda's, which is the original vacuum.
Yeah.
Right. And it does. It has an optional refrigerator, and they made a point to say a real refrigerator versus like some kind of cool box that uses like a. Tie in with the AC or some sort of like Peltier device or something. So
it is beautiful though.
Yeah.
I mean, based on the pictures, some of the wood trim looks nice.
Yeah. And, you know, so this isn't the only 2021 minivan with all-wheel drive. You know, for 21, the Pacifica is getting an all-wheel drive option again, but only on the gas engine. The Pacifica Hybrid still is front-wheel drive only. But this will be the only all-wheel drive hybrid.
And I think, honestly, that's what the 2021 Sienna really does, is it moves itself from sort of an ever-present competitor because it's a Toyota and it's a van to actually being a legitimate competition for the Pacifica. Because I really feel like the Pacifica is kind of the best value, best van in that space. You know, and there's plenty of options. You know, you've got the Pacifica, you've got the Odyssey, the Sienna, and the Sedona. So there's and maybe the Nissan Quest, I forget. maybe not.
No,
if the Quest is still available.
Isn't that telling our expressions right now? We're like, wait a minute.
It's not good anyway. The Quest looked kind of cool when it came out, and it wasn't a good van.
Oh, I remember writing about the Nissan Quest that it was trying to be inappropriately sexy, like when like wearing a mini skirt to a funeral. Like that's what I can.
No, Quest is gone.
This is going. I mean, got kicked out of the family for that wardrobe malfunction.
Exactly.
But you know, I really feel like the Pacifica is the van to buy. It looks really good. It's comfortable. It's priced really well. There's a lot to recommend the Pacifica. And the sort of one stumbling block that it has is that it's FCA, and there's a lot of people who will sort of be suspect of FCA quality and durability. And so now there's a Toyota option that offers a lot of very similar features, probably for similar money, but it's all new and it's on a much better platform because the old Sienna shirt, like you said, it felt 15 years old. It absolutely did.
But no, this will definitely be serious competition for the Pacifica for sure.
Yeah.
And the Odyssey also.
Yeah, and I think the Odyssey is probably still the best driving van because it has that sort of Honda feel to it. But I don't know that many people care about that. And the Odyssey sort of like trying to operate the tech and stuff in the Odyssey drives me bonkers because it sucks.
True.
So what do you think of the Venza? So the Venza, for those who haven't seen it, you know, is a two-row midsize crossover, and like, you know, it's got the same hybrid powertrain as the Sienna. Yeah. So what do you think of this one?
I'll let Rebecca go. Oh, you want me to go?
I think they had to, I mean, I think, well, I, there's a few thoughts going through my head, which is why I wanted Dan to go. I think
go if you want.
Yeah, this is an incredibly crowded segment. I mean, yeah. And to be fair, I didn't watch the preview thing. So where does it fit with the Highlander?
It's smaller than the Highlander, bigger than a RAV4.
They say it fits right in between. The problem is it's not enough bigger than the RAV4 and it's not enough smaller than the Highlander.
One part of, you know, where they're targeting this, you know, is if you look at the design, you know, the RAV4 has that, you know, kind of boxier, chunkier design.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, this is, you know, a sleeker design. This is basically a rebadged version of the Toyota Harrier, the Japanese market Toyota Harrier. Mm.
It's a Toyota RX, basically. It's an RX 450, basically.
Right. Well, and, you know, up until the current generation RX, you know, the previous generations of the Lexus RX were always sold in Japan as the Toyota Harrier. When they did the current generation, you know, it's still mechanically similar to, you know, basically the same as the RX, but the Harrier got a different design from the US market RX. And so, you know, this is, you know, a sleeker design. And what I'm thinking, you know, looking at this, it's kind of, in some ways, a similar strategy to what Ford's done with the Escape, where, you know, they took the Escape this year, you know, with the new generation Escape, and they kind of bifurcated it and made the Escape more car-like.
Right.
And, you know, more, you know, tall hatchback, you know, kind of thing. And then they're bringing out this Bronco Sport, which is the rugged off-road vehicle based on the same architecture.
Okay.
Know, and that's going to be, you know, have that, you know, kind of brawn eater styling to it. And I think, you know, this is kind of the Toyota Escape, if you will, you know, kind of a similar
strategy. And what's the brawny one? Is there a brawny one?
That's where the RAV4 would be, you know, although the RAV4 is not an off-roader like the Bronco Sport.
I just said the RAV4 TRD though.
Right.
Was a riot.
Did you read? I just got my latest Car and Driver. And so Ezra Dyer took one to an off-road park in North Carolina with a Wrangler. And he was like, surely the Wrangler's going to kick his ass.
The RAV4?
RAV4 TRD. And he's like, surely this thing's going to get stuck with water up to the door handles and stuff. And it just hung in. It just, that's like everything. There was a point where he was like in the creek and the all-wheel drive system overheated. So he had to just wait until it cooled down. And, you know, the rushing water helped him out there. It did everything. It was like, I'm definitely going to get this thing stuck. And it
that's hilarious.
Sort of just tenacious than he thought it was going to be.
Awesome. I had a great time with it. I felt a little like a poser though.
Yeah. So I do think you're right though. The general RAV4 doesn't really feel brawny. That's not what I think of. I guess there may be space for the Venza. It makes me think that it's going to wind up like the do you remember the Accord Crosstour?
Crosstour, yes.
So that was sort of aimed at the somewhat older, more affluent buyer, or that's who wound up buying it. They thought it was going to be whatever. It kind of missed the mark, but I feel like there is a buyer for the Venza who wants some more style. Doesn't need as much utility as the RAV4 offers, but also doesn't need something as large as the Highlander. So there's probably some buyers there. I don't know how many.
Yeah, there's an elegance to it. I'm just glancing at it. It doesn't, they reference Apple CarPlay. They don't reference Android Auto. Are you kidding me? This thing hasn't even come out yet. I think the styling, you know, again, we're looking at pictures, but I think the styling is really sharp, actually. I like the back a lot.
Yeah, I do too.
It looks very elegant. I mean, I can see, you know, this is definitely going to be a niche market. It's a little on the feminine side. So I could see, you know, professional women going for a car.
Not terrible though, right? Like,
right. Not terrible. Because I'm thinking for myself, like the RAV4, I mean, the thing was a riot, but it was small. Like I felt I wanted to be in a little bit larger vehicle for everyday use. It didn't feel premium enough. But then the Highlander to me is too big and kind of too family-ish, right, and such. So I think that I hope they do the marketing correctly on the Venza. I hope they don't have just a car full of chicks on their way to a bar seeking a man. I mean, I think that there's an opportunity here because I do think that it's elegant looking. I think there is a possibility for this thing. It's just they have to market it correctly and clearly. You know, they have to have a clear marketing scheme for it and not just sort of throw spaghetti at the wall.
They should contact.
And for what it's worth, in the press release, it does say that it has Android Auto and Alexa support.
Oh, isn't that I wonder why.
Oh, that's right. They talked about the Alexa in the little preview thing to it.
Well, it's because it says technology right before your eyes, behind the wheel, blah, blah, blah. In touchscreen display with Apple CarPlay, compatibility, seamlessly work together.
Are you looking at the...
I'm looking at the consumer website.
Oh, okay.
Under upcoming vehicle.
On the media site, the press release, the press kit talks about all that stuff.
All right. Well, they should update their consumer site.
So do you think this is basically... Do you think the Venza is basically like the crossover version of the Avalon? Where...
Yeah. I think that's actually a good way to describe it. So yeah, a little more premium looking, a little more upmarket, relative to the Camry, and this would be the same thing, relative to the RAV.
Yeah. So I don't know. It was just a cool way to spend about 15 minutes in the middle of a day. Made me feel like the old days when we had car shows. You remember car shows? Remember going to events?
So
I vaguely remember something about that. Yeah. We may even have some again someday.
Maybe.
We got one more Toyota before we leave Toyota.
All right, let's talk about the last Toyota.
Go for it, Dan.
So it is 20 years of Priuses. So the Prius, which seems to be kind of dwindling in popularity a bit, but they're coming out with a 20th anniversary Toyota Prius to celebrate the fact that the car that sort of started it all has been around for a while. And the hilarious thing to me is that it's actually a 2021 model.
Well, not only that, but the Prius actually debuted in 1997 in Japan. It's 20 years in North America.
Yeah. So, I mean, those things aside, it's not really all that different from the regular Prius. It's got like some different trim and stuff like that.
It's got black wheels.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the bigger point that I'm taking is Toyota is really still committed to electrification, but not full EVs. And so to celebrate the hybrid, like I feel like at some point in the late 90s, Toyota said, we're going to do this hybrid thing and then we're going to pivot to fuel cells. And that pivot to fuel cells just hasn't happened. And they haven't gone back for another bite at like a full EV in a sort of a wholehearted way. But the Prius itself, I think it's a worthy thing to celebrate and to bring up because it really did shift the paradigm a lot. And we're past the point where you remember how hated the Prius was for like, mm-hmm. I don't know, 5, maybe 10 years. Like nobody liked them. They were ugly. They were
maybe 20.
I don't know. I have a lot of respect for the Prius now. Like it's definitely not an exciting car.
No, but it is a good car in from a technical standpoint, it's outstanding.
Yeah.
Well, and it really, from a marketing standpoint, one of the things that it did was it was really one of the first hybrids that was its own model as opposed to, you know, like the fine print, like the Ford Escape hybrid that was in a certain color, you know, or the GM, the GMC or the Chevy Silverado, that not the Silverado, the Suburbans that had like the big hybrids across the side of it. This was like when you pulled up in a Prius, like Leonardo DiCaprio, you were in a hybrid and everybody knew that. They didn't have to look at the badging.
It was the quintessential virtue signaling.
That's true. You know what? And this is one of the things that I think you wouldn't have Tesla without the Prius.
Probably not.
Because the Prius sort of showed that, hey, this odd looking little car, this different technology. Nobody really knows about the technology, but everybody knows that this is like, it's a green car, right? It's saving the planet.
Right.
So let me buy the car. So
and you're welcome.
Yeah.
Right. And
that's what the Model 3 is today. The Model 3 is the new Prius, you know, and it's funny if you go to LA these days, or at least, you know, before the pandemic, you know, there's Teslas everywhere, and there's Priuses everywhere, but all the Priuses are now taxi cabs. Right. You know, taxi cabs in LA, the most common taxi cab in LA is the Prius, and then people who were driving Priuses 10 years ago, 15 years ago are driving Model 3s now.
Well, you know, they're upwardly mobile after all. But I think the cat has some thoughts.
Oh my gosh. I'm so sorry.
No, I think it really has had a pretty big effect on the whole market, though. The footprint of the Prius is a lot larger than maybe you'd consider, just sort of how it developed. Electrification, battery technology has improved because it's out there, motor technology, and just consumer acceptance. So it's kind of amazing to me that the Prius has been around for 20 years, and I expect it to not be around for another 20. Like, I think that the idea was always to sunset the Prius after people got used to it.
I think that was probably the idea in the early days. And then there was a period you know, around 2010, 2011, 2012, where they actually tried, you know, the Prius had become so popular that they actually tried to expand it into a sub brand of its own. And they had a family of Priuses. You had the Prius, you had the bigger Prius V, and then the smaller Prius C. And the C and the V never really caught on in the same way as the classic Prius.
Right.
When the latest generation Prius came out, you know, they did what they did with the design, and, you know, it's been downhill ever since. But
the audience was very different though, too, when they tried to expand the brand.
Yeah, no, that's true. You know, the Prius, you know, I think in part because of the way it looked, you know, it was one of those classic, you know, vehicle, you know, designs that attracted early adopters, you know, yep. And those that were virtue signaling, as I said, you know, and then it never really broke into the mainstream. You know, it started to, but then it kind of stalled, especially when gas prices went down. But right. They took the technology that they learned from the Prius, and Toyota's put that into almost everything they build now. You know, pretty much the only Toyotas that don't have hybrid options now are the Tacoma and Tundra. And the Forerunner.
Yeah. I'm
pretty sure that when the next generation Tundra is due sometime in the next year, and I would be shocked if they don't have a hybrid version of the new Tundra.
Yeah. I mean, that would give them some sort of market leadership there too. But I think the key about adopting that Prius technology across the lineup is they saw what happened when you try to expand the Prius lineup. You know, by going smaller and larger. And at that point, you're building another brand within a brand, which is expensive and not really smart.
So especially when they also had Scion that they were trying to promote at the same time.
Right. So yeah. I think they sort of got burned twice there, where it didn't work. So now the idea is, well, everybody knows the Prius. Let's take that, you know, Prius propulsion technology, and we'll put it over in the Camry and the Corolla. And we can say, when we go to sell these things, hey, you know, you want a hybrid, or you want a hybrid, but you need a Highlander. Well, this has, you know, technology that was, you know, originally in the Prius, but, you know, we understand you need more space. So here, check it out in the Highlander. Same great taste, you know, new, larger size kind of thing.
Toyota sells more RAV4 hybrids now than they do Priuses. Last year, they sold 400,000 RAV4s in the U.S. 25% of those had hybrids in them, and they sold 67,000 Priuses.
I loved the RAV4 hybrid. I really liked it quite a bit. So, I mean, the tech is great. It's been really, really well refined, and there's no real penalty for buying it other than cost. But the cost has come down too, so it's not like it's unobtainable.
Dan, you want to talk about Uconnect 5?
Yeah, so for those of us here in the Motoring Press in New England, FCA gave us a treat, and they walked us through Uconnect 5. They gave us a little presentation. So a lot of the stuff that we complain about, like lack of redundant buttons and touchscreens and stuff, I had the opportunity to sort of ask them and talk about. And they were very clear to say that they really do hear a lot that people want to have buttons for stuff, and that they're going to continue to do this. So they had Vince Galante, Nick Kappa, and Jin Palmer give us a little presentation about what features the Uconnect 5 has. And one of the things that really stood out is that it's they've simplified the graphics to make it a lot clearer, a lot easier to use, and they've sort of flattened the learning curve. So I'm at the point where now I need to try it. You know, they did a lot of UX testing, and they took those lessons and they adjusted the way it works. And you can customize this thing. So from an owner experience, I got the impression watching the presentation that if you own one of these cars, you're going to set the Uconnect up. And you know, they've got like favorite buttons and stuff. So you can do certain presets for the apps you want. You can move the apps around on the screen. And this is all stuff that is kind of in the current version of Uconnect as well, but they've refined it quite a bit. And it can support multiple displays. So you're going to see it. Basically, the Uconnect system is going to drive the instrument panel and the main screen and whatever else they dream up. They do a lot of testing for, you know, cold weather, for old age, for just making the systems easier.
Did you say old age?
Yeah. You know, that's a thing that you really have to consider, like, how are people going to use this? And their real goal, and it was great to hear FCA say this, was like, we want people to be able to sit in the car and use the system and not have a class, not have it explained to them, just be able to figure it out. And that was great to hear, because that's one of my sort of constant complaints, right? Is that these things are really, they're too complicated, and they're too pretty. Like, you guys are amusing yourselves. You're not making it easy to use.
There's nothing more frustrating than something that's not intuitive.
Right.
Yeah, they're going for form rather than function.
Right. So they get it. They really get it. And climate is, it was something that went into the screen in one version. This is back in like 2014 when they went to the newer version of Uconnect from like, I think Uconnect 3 or whatever. I forget. But then they discovered, like, nope, that needs to come back out. Believe us, we heard you. And now they have it where at the top of the display, there's always like the ever-present sort of, it's like the top of your browser window where you'll see the temperature and like your seat heater settings, and you press on that, you can get, like, it's a shortcut. No matter where you are, you can get right to it.
Very smart.
Through, like, a bunch of menu trees. So that stuff has gotten a lot more refined, and it's running on Android with faster hardware. So that's a big shift. I don't think before it ran on Android. So
it was on QNX before.
Right. Okay. So that was what, BlackBerry was
QNX? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think Android is actually a good move for them, but I wanted to sort of ping, you about that, Sam, like what the benefit is of going from something like QNX, which was pretty good at least a few years ago. And that was a good platform to be on to move over to Android. What does that give them?
So, this is actually Android Automotive, which is Google has taken the Android OS, it was originally developed for mobile devices, and they've made a version that's optimized for automotive use, to run in the automotive environment. And what's interesting is, that as part of Android Automotive, when a manufacturer decides to use that, they have the option to use what's called Google Automotive Services. So when you get an Android phone, there's a package of apps on most Android phones that, are bundled in there. It's Google Mobile Services. So that's your Gmail, your Google Maps, search, and, a bunch of other things, the calendar. There's all those Google apps that are bundled on most every Android phone. For Android Automotive, they were, they're offering what they call GAS, Google Automotive Services. So again, Google Maps, Waze, what else? There's a bunch of other ones, including Google Assistant. So you get the Assistant built in there. What's interesting is that FCA has chosen not to use Google Automotive Services, not to include Google Automotive Services. Volvo is also bringing out their next generation infotainment system is also built on Android Automotive, but they are using Google Automotive Services. So you'll have Google Assistant built in. FCA is using Android Automotive, but they've chosen to cherry pick a bunch of other services. So you have Alexa Automotive built in on top of that. You have TomTom for the maps instead of Google Maps. And I forget the other ones. There's a few other services that they're building in there that aren't Google services.
Over-the-air updates was a big thing that they talked about.
Over-the-air updates are available on there. And the other thing is, in general, on Android Automotive systems, you'll actually be able to download Android apps directly onto the head unit. So things like, your music apps, your Spotify and things like that, you can go to the Google Play Store right from the head unit, download those apps, so you don't necessarily have to use your phone to do that. Did they talk at all about, whether Uconnect 5 will have access to the Play Store, the Google Play Store?
They didn't talk about that, or at least I don't recall it. But they did talk about how you could add widgets and stuff like that. So, I think that in the future, there's certainly going to be. They did talk about how you can add features that the car didn't come with.
Right.
You can go and sort of, you can add it later. If it's a tech feature, you can download, you know, whatever, like if the car didn't come with nav, but it has whatever in it, you can go get it. That's my example. I'm sure if you have Uconnect 5, you probably have nav, but you know, one little piece, if they come out with something new that you want to add, you can again, go get it. And that's a real area where automakers, I think all automakers are probably looking at a way to sort of extend the life of their products and sort of extend the opportunity for features to be added so that, and get people to pay for it, which is kind of like a nice thing for them. Right. It just overall, I was really, and Uconnect 5 has been sort of announced since like early January. But I was impressed with the amount of thought they put into the system and how much they've sort of stripped it down from previous versions of Android because I felt like Uconnect was great at first. It was really friendly because it was limited, and then they added a lot of features to it and it got kind of bloated and crappy to use. And now they're figuring out how to keep the features and make it easy again.
So yeah. When is it coming out? When will it be unveiled? Like into
this fall on 2021 models, starting with the 21 Pacifica and some other stuff coming later this year.
And is it across all brands like Alpha and?
It'll be spreading across all the FCA brands. Okay. And it does also still have support for both Android Auto and CarPlay in there. So
I think it's confusing sometimes when you hear Android Auto.
Yeah. There's Android Automotive, which is the OS.
Right.
Well, and that was a specific question that I asked them, because in some cars, if you're using Android Auto or Apple CarPlay, it forces you to use Apple Maps or Google Maps. The way they've implemented it here, Apple CarPlay or Android Auto, the projection systems don't take over the full screen. They learned that that's not the best thing to do either, because people still want to get at the functionality that's in the head unit that's not in the phone. So they have a large enough screen now where it only takes up a portion, and you still have your other function.
Well, and that's actually true even now on Uconnect 4, on the current Uconnect 4 stuff. You still, if you plug in your phone, you still have a bar, a dock along the bottom edge of the screen with icons, to tap to get to the various embedded functions. So you can get to, the built-in nav if you want, and if you don't want to use the Google or Apple Maps.
Yeah. I got to say, I'm not a fan of Uconnect 4. I don't like it. So I think that this is a good improvement. So it was cool to see that they've updated it so thoughtfully, and it was also cool that they put on a little presentation for us. So thank you. it was nice to like chat with all our friends at FCA for a moment and feel like we're not stuck at home.
Nice.
Yeah, I actually got a demo of it from Nick at the Chicago Auto Show, and I got a video that I posted on YouTube. I'll include that in the show notes so you can get an idea of what it looks like.
Yeah, it's cool, and I'm I think that people are going to like it. They're going to like some of the features. Yeah, and it does the Android Auto and CarPlay wirelessly, which is also nice.
Like mm-hmm. that is really nice.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it next week, but Audi is coming out with their MIB3. So I think that we are starting to see a lot of improvements and a lot of changes and upgrades to the infotainment systems, because it's still a relatively new thing in vehicles, and each manufacturer is kind of trying to figure out what system is their best. So I have to write about that for something. And so we can talk about it next week.
Okay. All right. And we can also talk some more about Sync 4 next week as well, cool. from Ford, which is getting OTA update capability.
Nice.
That's also a new system that's got support for, wireless Android Auto and CarPlay, but it's also got a completely new interface as well.
So that's one of the things that the OTA updates, you'll hear folks say, well, Tesla's had that for like a decade, and that's true. But, and I think it's taken automakers this long to realize, we can do it and do it reliably. They've been very careful about it, but There's a lot of sort of thought that needs to go into to liability and who owns the data and how it's going to actually roll out. So I'm glad that they finally solved that. It's not that it has been impossible on sort of mainstream automakers' vehicles, it's that they've been careful. And I think that we're going to see it be robust as it goes forward, instead of, you know, having issues with it failing and stuff like that. I think they've gotten it to a point where we're going to see everybody get OTA updates across their lineups, especially as they change architectures now, where it wasn't.
That's the key is having an electrical architecture that can support it,
yeah.
Electronic architecture that can support it, and GM's new. Global B electrical architecture that's rolling out this year has support for full OTA update capability. Ford's new stuff, you're going to see it from FCA and from and Volkswagen Group and everybody else is starting to roll that out this year.
Yeah. So that's just sort of a little shorthand of demonstration of the inertia in the industry where, you know, they've got platforms that take a while to redo, to make things possible. That, you know, yes, when you design it in from the start and it's your only product, it's there and you get a jump on competition. I think everybody's sort of starting to catch up and do it really well. So that's good. I would like to go not have to go back to the dealer to upgrade my nav maps. That would be cool.
That would be nice, right?
Yeah. All right. So I think I've babbled enough about Uconnect 5. So I think we're done on topics.
I think that's good. That's good for today.
Yeah, I think that's good for the podcast.
And we'll try and get this one out in less than 3 weeks.
Jeez, savage.
So I do have just one thing to add, and I didn't clear this with you guys. But the analyst community and the automotive community, a good friend of mine named Jim Ehrlich died in a surfing accident last Monday. He used to work for Hyundai. He was worked at Kelley Blue Book with me, and he was just such a great guy and a friend to a lot of journalists, a lot of people in the industry. And so I just wanted to say rest in peace, Jim.
All right.
I got nothing. But that sucks.
Yeah. It does. Yeah. It's a huge loss. He was just such a creative, funny instigator. and so I just wanted, for our listeners, Jim Ehrlich is his name, and he was working at GFK at the time, but worked for Hyundai, as I said, Hyundai Capital, worked for just Kelley Blue Book and a group of others, and a lot of people knew him. And so it's a sad loss. It really is. And so just wanted to give him a shout out and just thinking of his mom and his daughter. So thank you.
Okay.
Thanks. And we'll talk to you all next time.
All right. Stay safe, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Wheel Bearings. Find us at wheelbearings.media and on Twitter as @wheelbearingscast. Remember, there's only one vowel, that's the A in cast. We're also at Car Review Tweets on Twitter, or you could just email us. That's feedback@wheelbearings.media. Thanks again for listening to Wheel Bearings.
Power your adventures with the all-electric 2024 Subaru Solterra. It has the rugged versatility of standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and 8.3 inches of ground clearance. It's the most advanced Subaru ever, with our latest safety technology and zero emissions. The 2024 Subaru Solterra. Love is now electric. Visit your local Wasatch Front Subaru store for current offers and details.
Is your aging AC system ready for summer? Are you sure? Don't get caught when it's hot out. Instead, plan ahead with a free AC system inspection by Kelly's Heating and Cooling. Kelly's cares. So this spring, they're offering free home HVAC inspections. Appointments booked before the end of April might qualify for up to $8,900 back on a new high-efficiency, space-saving Daikin Fit system. So make sure you can take the heat this summer. Search for Kelly's Cooling online. Because they're more than hot air, Kelly's cares.